Chapter 15. He should receive a tincture of other liberal studies which he had painfully missed in his own military career. The Baron chose to keep his son for the last 7 years at our college, until he was now entering upon his 23rd year. For the four last he had lived with me as the sole pupil whom I had, or meant to have, had not the brilliant proposals of the young Russian guardsman persuaded me to break my resolution. Ferdinand von Erlstein had good talents, not dazzling but respectable, and so amiable were his temper and manners, that I had introduced him everywhere, and everywhere he was a favorite, and everywhere, indeed, except exactly there where only in this world he cared for favor. Margaret Liebenheim, she it was whom he loved, and had loved for years, with the whole ardor of his ardent soul. She it was for whom, or at whose command, he would willingly have died. Early he had felt that in her hands lay his destiny, that she it was who must be his good or his evil genius. At first, and perhaps to the last, I pitied him exceedingly. But my pity soon ceased to be mingled with respect. Before the arrival of Mr. Wyndham he had shown himself generous, indeed magnanimous. But never was there so painful an overthrow of a noble nature as manifested itself in him. I believe that he had not himself suspected the strength of his passion, and the sole resource for him, as I said often, was to quit the city, to engage in active pursuits of enterprise, of ambition, or of science. But he heard me as a somnambulist might have heard me dreaming with his eyes open. Sometimes he had fits of reverie, starting, fearful, agitated. Sometimes he broke out into maniacal movements of wrath, invoking some absent person, praying, beseeching, menacing some air-woe phantom. Sometimes he slunk into solitary corners, muttering to himself, and with gestures sorrowfully significant, or with tones and fragments of expostulation that moved the most callous to compassion. Still he turned a deaf ear to the only practical counsel that had a chance for reaching his ears. Like a bird under the fascination of a rattlesnake, he would not summon up the energies of his nature to make an effort at flying away. "Beckon, while it is time," said others, as well as myself, for more than I saw enough to fear some fearful catastrophe. "Lead us not into temptation," said his confessor to him in my hearing, for, though Prussians, the von Erlsteins, were Roman Catholics, "lead us not into temptation. That is our daily prayer to God." "Then, my son, being led into temptation, do not you persist in courting, nay, almost tempting temptation. Try the effects of absence, though but for a month." The good father even made an overture toward imposing a penance upon him that would have involved an absence of some duration. But he was obliged to desist, for he saw that, without effecting any good, he would merely add spiritual disobedience to the other offenses of the young man. Ferdinand himself drew his attention to this, for he said, "Reverend father, do not you, with the purpose of removing me from temptation, be yourself the instrument for tempting me into a rebellion against the church. Do not you weave snares about my steps. Snares there are already, and but too many." The old man sighed, and desisted. Then came but enough. From pity, from sympathy, from counsel, and from consolation, and from scorn from each of these alike the poor stricken deer recoiled into the wilderness. He fled for days together into solitary parts of the forest, fled, as I still hoped and prayed, in good earnest, and for a long farewell, but, alas, no. Still he returned to the haunts of his ruined happiness and his buried hopes, at each return looking more like the wreck of his former self, and once I heard a penetrating monk observe, whose convent stood near the city gates, "There goes one ready equally for doing or suffering, and of whom we shall soon hear that he is involved in some great catastrophe, it may be of deep calamity, it may be of memorable guilt." So stood matters among us. January was drawing to its close, the weather was growing more and more winterly, high winds, piercingly cold, were raving through our narrow streets, And still the spirit of social festivity bade defiance to the storms which sang through our ancient forests. From the accident of our magistracy, being selected from the tradesmen of the city, the hospitalities of the place were far more extensive than would otherwise have happened. For every member of the corporation gave two annual entertainments in his official character. And such was the rivalship which prevailed, that often one quarter of the year's income was spent upon these galas. Nor was any ridicule thus incurred. For the costliness of the entertainment was understood to be an expression of official pride, done in honor of the city, not as an effort of personal display. It followed, from the spirit in which these half-yearly dances originated, that, being given on the part of the city, every stranger of rank was marked out as a privileged guest, and the hospitality of the community would have been equally affronted by failing to offer, or by failing to accept the invitation. Hence it had happened that the Russian guardsmen had been introduced into many a family which otherwise could not have hoped for such a distinction. Upon the evening at which I am now arrived, the 22nd of January, 1816, the whole city, in its wealthier classes, was assembled beneath the roof of a tradesman who had the heart of a prince. In every point our entertainment was superb, and I remarked that the music was the finest I had heard for years. Our host was in joyous spirits, proud to survey the splendid company he had gathered under his roof. Happy to witness their happiness, elated in their elation. Joyous was the dance, joyous were all faces, that I saw up to midnight, very soon after which time supper was announced, and that also, I think, was the most joyous of all the banquets I ever witnessed. The accomplished guardsman outshone himself in brilliance, aye, even his melancholy relaxed. In fact, how could it be otherwise? Near to him sat Margaret Liebenheim, hanging upon his words more lustrous and bewitching than ever I had beheld her. There she had been placed by the host, and everybody knew why. That is one of the luxuries attached to love. All men seat their places with pleasure, women make way. Even she herself knew, though not obliged to know, why she was seated in that neighborhood, and took her place, if with a rosy suffusion upon her cheeks, yet with fullness of happiness at her heart. The guardsman pressed forward to claim Miss Liebenheim's hand for the next dance, a movement which she was quick to favor by retreating behind one or two parties from a person who seemed coming toward her. The music again began to pour its voluptuous tides through the bounding pulses of the youthful company. Again the flying feet of the dancers began to respond to the measures. Again the mounting spirit of delight began to fill the sails of the hurrying night with steady inspiration. All went happily. Already had one dance finished, some were pacing up and down, leaning on the arms of their partners. Some were reposing from their exertions. When, oh heavens! What a shriek! What a gathering tumult! Every eye was bent toward the doors, every eye strained forward to discover what was passing. But there, every moment, less and less could be seen, for the gathering crowd more and more intercepted the view, so much the more was the ear at leisure for the shrieks redoubled upon shrieks. Miss Liebenheim had moved downward to the crowd. From her superior height she overlooked all the ladies at the point where she stood. In the center stood a rustic girl, whose features had been familiar to her for some months. She had recently come into the city, and had lived with her uncle, a tradesman, not 10 doors from Margaret's own residence, partly on the terms of a kinswoman, partly as a servant on trial. At this moment she was exhausted with excitement, and the nature of the shock she had sustained. Mere panic seemed to have mastered her. And she was leaning, unconscious and weeping, upon the shoulder of some gentleman, who was endeavoring to soothe her. A silence of horror seemed to possess the company, most of whom were still unacquainted with the cause of the alarming interruption. A few, however, who had heard her first agitated words, finding that they waited in vain for a fuller explanation, now rushed tumultuously out of the ballroom, to satisfy themselves on the spot. The distance was not great, And within 5 minutes several persons returned hastily, and cried out to the crowd of ladies, that all was true which the young girl had said. What was true? That her uncle Mr. Weishaupt's family had been murdered. That not one member of the family had been spared, namely, Mr. Weishaupt himself and his wife, neither of them much above 60, but both infirm beyond their years. Two maiden sisters of Mr. Weishaupt, from 40 to 46 years of age, and an elderly female domestic. An incident happened during the recital of these horrors, and of the details which followed, that furnished matter for conversation even in these hours, when so thrilling an interest had possession of all minds. Many ladies fainted, among them Miss Liebenheim, and she would have fallen to the ground but for Maximilian, who sprang forward, and caught her in his arms. She was long of returning to herself, and, during the agony of his suspense, he stooped and kissed her pallid lips. That sight was more than could be borne by one who stood a little behind the group. He rushed forward, with eyes glaring like a tiger's, and leveled a blow at Maximilian. It was poor, maniacal von Erlstein, who had been absent in the forest for a week. Many people stepped forward, and checked his arm, uplifted for a repetition of this outrage. One or two had some influence with him, and led him away from the spot, while as to Maximilian, so absorbed was he, that he had not so much as perceived the affront offered to himself. Margaret, on reviving, was confounded at finding herself so situated amid a great crowd, and yet the prudes complained that there was a look of love exchanged between herself and Maximilian, that ought not to have escaped her in such a situation. If they meant by such a situation, one so public, it must be also recollected, that it was a situation of excessive agitation. But, if they alluded to the horrors of the moment, no situation more naturally opens the heart to affection and confiding love than the recoil from scenes of exquisite terror. An examination went on that night before the magistrates, but all was dark, although suspicion attached to a negro named Aaron, who had occasionally been employed in menial services by the family, and had been in the house immediately before the murder. The circumstances were such as to leave every man in utter perplexity, as to the presumption for and against him. His mode of defending himself, and his general deportment, were marked by the coolest, nay, the most sneering indifference. The first thing he did, on being acquainted with the suspicions against himself, was to laugh ferociously, and to all appearance most cordially and unaffectedly. He demanded whether a poor man like himself would have left so much wealth as lay scattered abroad in that house: gold repeaters, massy plate, gold snuff boxes untouched. That argument certainly weighed much in his favor, and yet again it was turned against him, for a magistrate asked him how he happened to know already that nothing had been touched. True it was, and a fact which had puzzled no less than it had awed the magistrates, that, upon their examination of the premises, many rich articles of bijouterie, jewelry, and personal ornaments, had been found lying underhanged, and apparently in their usual situations, articles so portable that in the very hastiest flight some might have been carried off. In particular, there was a crucifix of gold, enriched with jewels so large and rare, that of itself it would have constituted a prize of great magnitude. Yet this was left untouched, though suspended in the little oratory that had been magnificently adorned by the elder of the maiden sisters. There was an altar, in itself a splendid object, furnished with every article of the most costly material and workmanship, for the private celebration of Mass. This crucifix, as well as everything else in the little closet, must have been seen by one at least of the murderous party, for hither had one of the ladies fled, hither had one of the murderers pursued. She had clasped the golden pillars which supported the altar, had turned perhaps her dying looks upon the crucifix. For there, with one arm still wreathed about the altar foot, though in her agony she had turned round upon her face, did the elder sister lie, when the magistrates first broke open the street door. and upon the beautiful parquet, or inlet floor which ran round the room, were still impressed the footsteps of the murderer. These, it was hoped, might furnish a clue to the discovery of one at least among the murderous band. They were rather difficult to trace accurately, those parts of the traces which lay upon the black tessellae being less distinct in the outline than the others upon the whiter colored. Most unquestionably, so far as this went, it furnished a negative circumstance in favor of the Negro, for the footsteps were very different in outline from his, and smaller, for Aaron was a man of colossal build. And as to his knowledge of the state in which the premises had been found, and his having so familiarly relied upon the fact of no robbery having taken place as an argument on his own behalf, he contended that he had himself been among the crowd that pushed into the house along with the magistrates, that, from his previous acquaintance with the rooms and their ordinary condition, a glance of the eye had been sufficient for him to ascertain the undisturbed condition of all the valuable property most obvious to the grasp of a robber, that, in fact, he had seen enough for his argument before he and the rest of the mob had been ejected by the magistrates. But, finally, that independently of all this, he had heard both the officers, as they conducted him, and all the tumultuous gatherings of people in the street, arguing for the mysteriousness of the bloody transaction upon that very circumstance of so much gold, silver, and jewels being left behind untouched. In 6 weeks or less from the date of this terrific event, the Negro was set at liberty by a majority of voices among the magistrates. In that short interval, other events had occurred no less terrific and mysterious. In this first murder, though the motive was dark and unintelligible, yet the agency was not so. Ordinary assassins apparently, and with ordinary means, had assailed a helpless and unprepared family, had separated them, attacked them singly in flight, for in this first case all but one of the murdered persons appeared to have been making for the street door, and in all this there was no subject for wonder, except the original one, as to the motive. But now came a series of cases destined to fling this earliest murder into the shade. Nobody could now be unprepared, and yet the tragedies, henceforward, which passed before us, one by one, in sad, leisurely, or in terrific groups, seemed to argue a lethargy like that of apoplexy in the victims, one and all. The very midnight of mysterious awe fell upon all minds. 3 weeks had passed since the murder at Mr. Weishaupt's, 3 weeks the most agitated that had been known in this sequestered city. We felt ourselves solitary, and thrown upon our own resources, all combination with other towns being unavailing from their great distance. Our situation was no ordinary one. Had there been some mysterious robbers among us, the chances of a visit, divided among so many, would have been too small to distress the most timid, while to young and high-spirited people, with courage to spare for ordinary trials, such a state of expectation would have sent pulses of pleasurable anxiety among the nerves. But murderers, exterminating murderers, clothed in mystery and utter darkness, these were objects too terrific for any family to contemplate with fortitude. Had these very murderers added to their functions those of robbery, they would have become less terrific. 9 out of every 10 would have found themselves discharged, as it were, from the roll of those who were liable to a visit, while such as knew themselves liable would have had warning of their danger in the fact of being rich, and would, from the very riches which constituted that danger, have derived the means of repelling it. But, as things were, no man could guess what it was that must make him obnoxious to the murderers. Imagination exhausted itself in vain guesses at the causes which could by possibility have made the poor Weishaupts objects of such hatred to any man. True, they were bigoted in a degree which indicated feebleness of intellect, but that wounded no man in particular, while to many it recommended them. True, their charity was narrow and exclusive, but to those of their own religious body it expanded munificently, and, being rich beyond their wants, or any means of employing wealth which their gloomy asceticism allowed, they had the power of doing a great deal of good among the indigent papists of the suburbs. As to the old gentleman and his wife, their infirmities confined them to the house. Nobody remembered to have seen them abroad for years. How, therefore, or when could they have made an enemy? And, with respect to the maiden sisters of Mr. Wyshop, they were simply weak-minded persons, now and then too censorious, but not placed in a situation to incur serious anger from any quarter, and too little heard of in society to occupy much of anybody's attention. Conceive, then, that 3 weeks have passed away, that the poor Wyshops have been laid in that narrow sanctuary which no murderer's voice will ever violate. Quiet has not returned to us, but the first flutterings of panic have subsided. People are. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.